Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SupChina. Subscribe to SupChina's daily email newsletter to stay on top of the latest news from China, or download our new and improved smartphone app, or visit the website at supchina.com. It's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. And while you're there, check out our new business news podcast, the Caixin Cynical Business Brief, for a weekly roundup of top stories from Caixin, China's authoritative source for business and financial news. I'm Kaiser Guo, joined, of course, by Jeremy Goldcorn, who is casting his eyes about with suspicion and horror, because we are, I kid you not, we are in Trump Tower in Midtown Manhattan, Trump Tower
in the hotel anyway, where we've come to talk to one of the towering figures in the Chinese tech world, Dr. Kai-Fu Lee. Kai-Fu Lee is many, many things. He's a popular author and speaker, a very successful venture investor and incubator, the former head of not only Microsoft, but also Google in China. He's also a cancer survivor in remission after treatment for stage 4 lymphoma. Kai-Fu is in New York because not only did his daughter graduate from Columbia, but Kai-Fu was the commencement speaker at Columbia's engineering school just the other day.
He's just published a book about artificial intelligence in Chinese, and AI is not only something he's been thinking about very deeply, but also an area where his venture fund, Sinovation Ventures, is deeply invested. In fact, Sinovation, which some of you may still know by its former name, which is Innovation Works, now operates the Sinovation Ventures Artificial Intelligence Institute. And today, much of our conversation will focus on AI, specifically in China. Kai-Fu, great to see you again, and thanks so much for making the time.
Well, pleasure to be here, and I'm merely a resident in the Trump residence.
My first question. What are we doing here?
Before we do that, we need to introduce another special guest who just joined us. We walked into the suite where Kai-Fu's staying, and we happened to see an old friend, Jiayang Fan from The New Yorker, who was just finishing up an interview. So we asked her to stay along, an old friend of the podcast, of course. So she'll join in as a host.
I'm very happy to be here. It is a bit of a surprise to see you too, but always a pleasure.
Well, good. When is she going to make her cooking show debut?
Well, we're working.
I was just going to grill you about that, Jeremy.
It's coming. We're right. working on it. So, Kai-Fu, can I ask, why are we in the Trump Tower?
Because a friend of mine owns this suite, and he rents it to me at a good price.
Okay.
Does that make it acceptable?
Oh, absolutely. All right. LP is really happy that you're saving money.
Yes.
Good. So we started our podcast, Kai-Fu, a little over 7 years ago, and our first episode taped on April 1st, 2010. The show was about Google's exit from China. David Drummond, who was Google's chief legal officer, dropped that blog post on January 12th announcing that he would no longer comply with censorship, even if it meant exiting the China market. And then after, of course, there was that clever workaround where they were redirecting all search queries to Hong Kong. Then finally, in late March, the other shoe fell, and Google was actually blocked and continued to be blocked sporadically at first, and then with some finality. And so we taped our first show about that. Kai-Fu, you left Google in September of 2009, is that right?
That's correct, before the incident.
Yeah, so now it's been over 7 years. I'm hoping you can now talk candidly about how you felt about your decision to leave Google and Google's decision essentially to leave China.
Sure. My decision to leave Google had nothing to do with that. Mm-hmm. It was all about seeing the rising markets in the internet, in particular at the time mobile internet. And also I saw many of my top people leave to do startups, and I saw the venture community becoming mature, and I felt it was the right time to do an early stage fund, because that was the only area in the entire chain that was immature and not being sufficiently helpful to entrepreneurs. So we started an early stage fund called Sinovation Ventures now. Now, about Google's decision, it's obviously sad to see the work that I've put in, the market share gains that we saw, the brand that we built, the followers we had, were disappointed. but that was a decision they chose to make. I think looking back, the greatest product that Google China produced appears to have been its people,
yes.
Many of whom we are funding, many of whom are executives at top companies. And it was a real honor and pleasure to have had the chance to work with them.
Well, as you know, I worked for one of the main competitors of Google, but even so, I would say, and I said often then, that I would say Google was probably the American internet company that was most successful in China. I mean, it had a brand that was synonymous with innovation, with integrity, with global connectivity. It actually left a brand imprint in China unlike any other, I think, Western internet company. You probably deserve some of the credit for that, but it must have really broken your heart. When you left, around the time that you were leaving, Operation Aurora, were you already aware of the hacking attacks that Google alleges were the real reason behind?
No, okay. They had nothing to do with that. Did not know any of that.
And so afterward, mm-hmm. I mean, I was probably among the many people who thought that Google's decision was probably wrong, that they had come in 2006, in early 2006, with this idea that, look, it isn't total fulfillment of our mission, mm-hmm. but it is partial fulfillment. Mm-hmm. It's better than nothing. Some mm-hmm. connectivity, mm-hmm. some ability to offer choice was better than none. I think that I remember you saying things to that effect in the immediate aftermath, that you were not happy with the way Google handled the decision to leave.
I used the word happy, but I felt there was a need for search products that were fair, and the market always needs competition. And I felt Google China did a good job. At the time I was there, balancing corporate policy and local law requirements. And I thought that could be maintained. But obviously, after I left, Google decided it could not.
Let's shift topics a bit. I'd like to ask you about the culture of entrepreneurship in China. You spent a few years in the late 1990s with Microsoft Research in China, just as the first wave of returnee tech founders like Charles Zhang were coming back and homegrown entrepreneurs like Jack Ma were starting some of China's first internet behemoths. Back then, you could hardly say that China had anything like a culture of tech entrepreneurship. Even 10 years later, say in 2008, it would be easy to imagine parents of, you know, a recent Tsinghua engineering graduate dissuading their son or daughter from trying to start a company and urging them to take a safe job with IBM or Huawei or Google or Baidu. But something's definitely changed. And I mean, for me, this kind of was crystallized. I have some friends who are peasants, peasant farmers in a village in Hebei, and their son, who's in his early 20s, a few years ago, they'd been trying to get me to help him get a job at a big, you know, conservative multinational company. And because Procter & Gamble, right. HR department has me on speed dial. Anyway, I visited them in February when Kaiser and I were in China for a trip earlier this year. And I spent a whole afternoon talking to their son about his startup ideas. and if I had to myself name a single event that perhaps catalyzed the change, I'd probably say it was Alibaba's IPO and Jack Ma's ascent to the top of China's rich list. But there are a lot of other factors. What do you think they are? You know, how did this new, and it really is new. I mean, for me, it feels like it's just, I mean, 5 years maybe. At maximum, this culture of startup entrepreneurialism. How did this come about in China?
I would agree. Jack Ma's ascension to the top was very important because I think he felt like the boy next door, right? With Robin Lee and Charles Zhang, you know, people felt like these were superstar PhD types. Maybe that's not for me. But Jack really, you know, the fact that his stories that he couldn't get a job at Kentucky Fried Chicken, you know, I think that made everybody feel I could be like
and
that too.
And he can't code.
That's right. He can't code. Exactly. I think that was probably a very large, big event. I would like to think the founding of Sinovation Ventures was helpful for that to the belief to change as well. I remember in the first year.
Yeah, I don't think you need to be modest about that, actually. I mean, you know, you're following on
Chinese
social media.
Well, you were supposed to say that, but you didn't, so I am. but, you know, I remember the days when we started. You know, I was on a lot of TV and internet and talking about why the age of entrepreneurship has arrived. And there were a lot of skeptics that at the time, an incubator like us could make any difference. And we had lots of debates. And I think those debates changed some people's minds. But I still remember the first set of engineers I tried to bring on board to work on the startups. I remember having to wine and dine their parents and tell them I would take care of their kids, writing a 7-page letter to one of the parents. Those were the depths to which I went.
Wow.
to persuade them to let me take care of their kids, to join me in entrepreneurship. Because these weren't the startup CEOs, but they were, you know, they were rejecting jobs from multinationals and Baidu, Alibaba, and Tencent, and take a much lower salary in a startup and the risks that came with it. Fortunately, at least monetary-wise, I think their parents are quite happy today with all of them, but it wasn't easy. But anyway, I think myself and Bob Xu and others who were early in getting the early stage investment going was helpful as a catalyst to getting the country to understand entrepreneurship is something that should be encouraged for the people who want it. But I would say there's nothing as big as the government push that ultimately changed people's mind. The shuangchuang, right? The, the double innovation. Let everybody be an entrepreneur. Let everybody be an innovator. That statement, I think, shifted more people's minds than anything else added up together. And that has become, I think, a double-edged sword. I think on the one hand, entrepreneurship is now accepted. It's good. Everybody wants it. On the other hand, there are some misinterpretations because
irrational exuberance over
right. And also, I think the biggest issue is not having enough people explain the next level of detail. That entrepreneurship isn't about making the next Baidu and Alibaba only. It's also about the service economy, about opening a coffee shop, about opening a Taobao store, about becoming a driver of DD and also someone who does deliveries for people to become self-employed. I think if we take this to the right step and say entrepreneurship includes a large number of people in the service and self-employment area, then that definitely takes China in the right direction, because most people, entrepreneurs who want to be entrepreneurs, cannot do the next Alibaba, and they could do the smaller service level things. And with the way the employment pyramid will shape, we really need people to become self-employed. There will be more smaller companies than large ones. There will be more self-employment than large company employment. There will be more service jobs, especially with AI displacing many others.
The government push for entrepreneurship, I think, is understandable. And I think it's great that technology and innovation is being encouraged. But I wonder if there might possibly, or if there already is, friction between the creativity that's being encouraged, which naturally leads, I mean, especially when it comes to social issues, because, you know, technological innovation is as much about business as much as it is about the promotion of social good. For those grassroots organizations, that might lead to a need to collect information and share information. And one can see how that would easily butt up against political strictures on, you know, why that is, you know, ill-advised at a time when, you know, information is still, I think, to some respect, being
You don't need to dance around it.
Right. It's being restricted. So, do you feel like there is at all tension between the kind of comprehensive development of creative technology and kind of the political pressures on information?
Yeah, this is a very common question that I get in America. I do not believe that is an issue. Not that I think it's a great thing. That's a separate discussion we could have. But I just think people understand where the boundaries are. Mm-hmm. There's so much room for entrepreneurship and innovation. You could do, you know, biotechnology. You could do social networks. You could do AI. You could do enterprise software. You could do a coffee shop. I think when you have that many choices of businesses you could start. And there are certain things you cannot do. I think most people just don't worry about the things they can't do because there's enough choices of what they can do. And among them, they'll find something they're excited about and they feel like they could succeed.
So Silicon Valley became such a hotbed for tech innovation in large part because at the time it sat right on top of the entire supply chain of technology. It was where the chip fabs were. It was where the design shops were. It was where so much of what was happening. We're seeing the same thing happening in China right mm-hmm. now, where we are sitting essentially, especially in mobile devices, in wearables, in IoT,
You got to explain IoT. Sorry.
Internet of Things, right? So, you know, and how much, I want to know how much it has helped that, especially in places like Shenzhen, mm-hmm. we're sitting right on top of that. I mean, it strikes me that with all the ODMs and all the OEMs there and all the component manufacturers as well, there's just...
That's way too much jargon.
Reduction. Well, no, I mean, everyone knows what I'm talking about. It's just such a reduction of friction, right? Mm-hmm. It's so easy to pick up a phone and you're speaking the same language, even the same dialect. And it's, you just pedal your OFO bike down the street to meet with the... iterate and prototype so much faster. Is this how significant has this been? And I mean, it's really how much does it cripple the United States that the manufacturing has fled?
Well, I don't ride OFO bike. I ride Mobike.
Are you invested in?
Of course.
Can we have some disclosure here, sir?
We do have some disclosure here. Yes, in Shenzhen, I think is a great place. It's a place that's full of people who just want to do something great. And they do have the advantage of the supply chain. The other exciting thing is they can supply to the China market, which has at a lower cost.
Right.
Right. So if you look at a lot of those products like, wearable devices, watches and rings and wristbands, the Chinese version that's locally made, can cost 1/5 or 1/10 the price. Mm. And that will drive up volume. And drive up the features. So the China market connected to Shenzhen production, I think, makes it doubly exciting. Now, having said that, the intelligent hardware isn't probably the hottest area right now.
It's not an area where you're particularly investing in either. Right?
We made some investments. Okay. We were pretty successful with our Xiaoyu Zaijia, as a product. We invest in some car devices.
What
is that type of? Yeah, Xiaoyu Zaijia is like an Amazon, Echo. The new Amazon Echo with the screen. Yeah, we actually did that before.
So it's
Amazon
a home
Echo.
Device that you can talk to.
It's a home device, right?
Yeah, it's a home device.
Your shopping.
And it can do all those things, but I think the number one feature is instant video conferencing with other mobile devices and connecting people to people. So we have made some success. I think overall, our intelligent investments are pretty good. Intelligent hardware are pretty good. But the overall area hasn't really taken off. I think it's going to take probably the 7-nano next step in terms of making these devices have less electrical usage and easier Wi-Fi and things like that.
Do you want to quickly explain 7-nano?
Yeah, it's just the next step in terms of making the semiconductor process even smaller. Yeah, it's a Taiwan Semiconductor, Intel are working on it.
More energy efficient.
Yeah, more energy efficient. Exactly. So I do think that day will come. And also, I think in the back end, these smart devices haven't had AI to aggregate the data and make them intelligent yet.
Right.
So they're just called intelligent devices, but they're really devices.
It seems that China, it now boasts a pretty fully fledged entrepreneurial ecosystem. You know, there's a huge market of eager adopters, lots of money to spend. We have investment capital, maybe too much, too few good deals possibly. There are funds in US dollars and in renminbi, basically at all stages. There are a number of different exit possibilities for tech companies, from a splashy NASDAQ IPO to an M&A deal with Tencent or Baidu or Alibaba. So what's missing, if anything? What would you like to see better developed within the tech entrepreneurial ecosystem in China?
The ecosystem is now complete. So from angel to A to venture to growth to PE to pre-IPO to stock market. And the stock market is now tiered with NEQ, NASDAQ equivalent, and then the NYSE equivalent. So NEQ is more the pink sheets equivalent. So the entire chain is complete. There are a few areas of strangeness. One is the Chinese stock share prices for tech stocks are inflated. For us, that's an advantage because a Chinese IPO can lead to a very good valuation, and there will be more M&A by companies whose stocks are overvalued to acquire companies at a premium. But that is a little bit out of whack. It's out of whack, but in a good way for us. And over time, that will, of course, reach an equilibrium with the U.S. I think another challenge is the increasing difficult fluidity of currency exchange. So an entrepreneur has to make a bad decision. Do I get US dollars or local currency? For us as VCs, we just got to make sure we have funds of both denominations.
And you do. You're actually have funds in both, right?
We have both, right. Yeah. But we have to balance them, and you can never second guess correctly which one is definitely the correct one.
Right.
So people go back and forth. It results in a lot of legal trouble and time that it takes.
But even 5 years ago, tech IPOs on a Chinese board were almost unheard of, right? And it's just amazing how much has changed.
Now it's very
just
fluid.
Absolutely commonplace.
Yeah, it's commonplace now. So many people are choosing China. Of course, as with any efficient market, as there's enough supply in the China market, their overvaluation will come down. Another big problem, I think, with China is the pendulum swings too far in both ways, right? Like 2 years ago, everyone's doing O2O, and the prices are going billions and billions. And then when they crashed, no one wants to put a cent in O2O, and companies were closing down. Today, everyone's excited about AI. And when a number of AI companies go out of business, there will be a swing to the other direction. So this overreaction and basically people groupthink is an issue both at the entrepreneur level as well as the venture capital level.
I want to ask you about something that I think is sort of more fundamental to, it's not really something in the ecosystem, maybe something more in the culture. A couple of years ago on our show, we had the very good fortune of inviting a philosopher named Anna Greenspan on, and she had written a book about futurity, specifically about Shanghai, about how the Chinese, young Chinese people especially, have a very different orientation, a different posture toward the future than you would find maybe perhaps in many countries of the West. Talking to her and reading her book has basically convinced me that this is one of the great advantages that China has, that while in most of the rest of the world, much of the rest of the world, maybe outside of Silicon Valley, the science fiction visions are dystopian and dark. Technology has really, has really screwed mankind in some fundamental way. We're kind of embarrassed by futurism. We use, Futurama, which was, the name of this General Motors exhibition in Shanghai, in New York in at the World's Fair. By the way, she opens her book talking about how at the Shanghai Expo in 2010, there was another, GM exhibit that was also about technology-driven futures. It feels like this is lost in the West and it's still present in China. I know when I went to work every day at Baidu, it was just, there was a buoyancy. Everyone really kind of believed in what they were doing, in the ability of technology to positively impact mankind. I don't know if you've noticed that you spent a lot of time in the West, but you were there maybe in a different time. You were spending your time in America when America still had that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like that's a change now that's happened?
Change in America?
A change in America or the rise of this buoyancy in China?
Yeah. Well, I think China today felt a lot like the Silicon Valley that I worked in the 90s.
Right. That's
so,
what I'm getting at.
So
yeah.
I'm not as in touch with today's pulse in America, but you're saying that's changed here with the young people.
Yeah, I think in the culture broadly, I think that there's a sort of cynicism. Even as we embrace technology as consumers, we kind of sneer at the idea of flying cars and, there's a lot of, Jeremy, you know what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah, I do think that there is a sort of a glowing optimism a lot of Chinese people feel about the future that isn't here in the, in the U.S. and in other
Well, that could be a problem for here then, because I think the optimism will drive more investment, more entrepreneurship,
exactly, right.
and more better products that will go international.
Well, I think perhaps what you guys are alluding to is this sense of optimism that's combined with possibly a naivete about what's possible, the sense that everything is possible, and that here, in the U.S., I mean, people's expectations are kind of managed by, you know, their sense of what's real and what's kind of impossible to achieve, and whether that's for the Chinese, whether that's both an advantage and a disadvantage, and that it gives them this kind of, this limitless sense of like the future, but also this possibly this naivete about, that makes them unable to distinguish what's achievable and what's not achievable.
Perhaps, yeah.
Yeah, I think in China, people don't debate as much about can this technology be used for bad things? How do you control the technology from going out of hand? How do you ensure fairness, remove bias?
Yeah.
Those questions come up a lot here. Mm-hmm. Morality question, mm-hmm. autonomous vehicles, there's a trolley problem. and I think that debate is alive and well here, mm-hmm. which I think is great for intellectual stimulation.
Mm-hmm.
But if that slows down the progress, mm-hmm. then countries like China will catch up. Because
there aren't so many ethical constraints. There isn't so much.
Right? Well, that's one way to put it. I would like to think we VCs and entrepreneurs would still try to ensure the products are put responsibly to good use without breaking laws or hurting people.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, I think people think more about execution results.
Mm-hmm.
And I think governments tend to look at ultimate efficacy as opposed to, specific details of two views and which is more prevalent.
Mm. Right.
Kaifu, Kaiser and I were privileged the other night to attend a speech you gave at the Harvard Club here in New York, and you talked about mega trends for China, essentially. Mm-hmm. Could you share with our listeners what you think some of the most important trends of the next decade and
sure.
onwards would be?
Sure. I talked about several big trends. First, let's talk about trends that have already happened. Actually, I just found the New York Times op-ed piece I wrote a few years ago where several of the predictions are now true. One is people's usage patterns are changed. We call this consumer upgrade. So people now eat the food delivery, and they want good food delivery. They're buying clothes not just on Taobao, but buying it on higher end. And people like to have good things in life. And that's one change. Another change is the fact that the phones have become wallets. People don't use cash, and nor do they need credit cards. That causes very effective transaction. Okay. And much lower cost and micropayments are possible. So China is already ahead. So those are some trends that have already happened. Some of the new trends that we see, one is in education and the power of internet in education. We see parents wanting everything for their only child. And if you can deliver an American teacher to their child remotely by video conferencing, they'll pay premium prices for that. And we're funding a number of companies in that area. We think enterprise software will be on the rise. It can hardly not be on the rise given it's zero. So,
right.
And that's going to be a huge area at some point. It will take time for that one, to catch. We think, internet-based entertainment will continue to be very innovative. We invested in some of the top shows. Some of these are video shows, debate shows, singing shows, idol girl group shows. I won't go into details here, but there.
You did talk about a couple of them, and they were very strange to me and interesting. There's one called SH48 or
SNH48.
Something.
SNH48. Yeah, you've been away too long from China.
Been, right.
This is the huge
I'm too
hit.
Old.
Yeah. Have you heard of the most beautiful Chinese girl in the 4,000 years?
Well,
that was part of that's one of them.
No, Cici, you are getting old.
But this is one of the campaigns that came out of SNH48. Basically, what SNH48 is, it has elements of Major League Baseball. It has elements of Tamagotchi. It has elements of Social Network. It has games of elements of computer gaming. So all the people participate in the development of these 200 girls from five cities. So the cities compete against each other. The girls compete against each other. They start out being like the girl next door, and then their fans give them feedback on what they should do to become superstar. And then a small number of them do become superstars. And as a creative agency, SNH48 takes a much higher percentage fee than the Hollywood fees. But in addition, there is a monetization from commercial, from movies, from as well as from the consumer payment. Because people pay to attend these concerts. They also pay to attend virtually. They also send virtual gifts, which fly across the roof of the theaters.
So this is some kind of like K-pop grassroots factory on steroids.
Exactly. That's a very good description.
Oh my God. Yes. But it sounds horribly retrograde in so many ways. I mean, in terms of gender identity, I mean, it's...
Well, there's one for boys, too.
Oh, okay.
Well, that makes sense. Does that make you feel better?
Sign me up, Jeremy.
All right.
Yeah. No, I don't think so.
But there are elements of this innovation of how do you appeal to people? How do you connect consumers faster to the product, right? If you think about how, you know, WeChat and Facebook and Snapchat have improved, it's because their products are connected to people and feedback instantly makes them better. So now we're connecting these to the development of the next Lady Gaga, if you will.
Right. I mean, I think, you know, so much of this new technology is, I think, you know, front of the line and really, you know, connecting people, you know, ordinary people to celebrities and it does, you know, make everyone sort of, you know, stay in front of their computers and phones. I wonder the degree to which the data and also the connectivity can be harnessed for social good. And what I mean is, in China, there's still this very entrenched problem of the rural and urban divide. And, you know, there is a substantial part of the population that still probably skipped over the laptop PC generation and now just have their phones. And how is it, you know, is it possible that we could harness the technology so that they can participate kind of in the society?
Yeah. Are there social entrepreneurs using the same technology and the same trends?
There are very few social entrepreneurs in China. So that's
got to be something that we can identify as missing from the ecosystem.
But that could change when the age of AI arrives and the data becomes available and then people don't have to worry about the money. Mm. Right? That's often an important part of getting it beyond the stage.
Yeah, and that's something that we're going to talk about in some depth because I know you've thought very long and hard about these particular issues.
Right, but let me give you kind of a worrisome example, mm-hmm. right? That, as you mentioned, in the fourth and fifth tier cities, mm-hmm. what do the young people do there right. as they connect to the internet? It turns out they actually use, they actually are not as connected to the mainstream WeChat, Weibo kinds of communities. Mm-hmm. As an example, there is a community that's largely by these small town young people called Kuaishou. Uh-huh. I don't know if you're familiar with that. They are creating, this is not our investment, they're creating celebrities who essentially do crazy things to attract a follower base. You know, they would eat a raw snake or put a dynamite in their pants and light it. Not dynamite, no, sorry. Firecracker, sorry. Okay. firecracker in their pants and light it.
Commit suicide.
No, not suicide, but they do hurt themselves as a way to attract fan base. And then they get a lot of fans and then they sell products to make a living.
So they're quite different from the Wanghong. Kuaishou and Wanghong are different concepts, I imagine.
We could call the Kuaishou popular people
a subset of Wanghong,
but uh-huh. they do so not because of their beauty
looks.
Or being or there's their talent, but because of their willingness to maim themselves and do crazy things.
So it's like Jackass.
It's like Jackass
online for Chinese people from fourth tier cities.
That's right. Okay. So that makes us feel better. It is Jackass, right?
Okay. So I want to spend most of the rest of our time talking about AI, which is, of course, the biggest mega trend that we're really talking about. Given China's history of strong central government control, especially economic control, most people would probably agree that, you know, the ethical and regulatory environment for big data and AI in China is more permissive than you would find in the U.S., maybe, or surprisingly permissive. First of all, would you agree that that's the case? And we talked about that. We flipped at it, and you had some misgivings. And second, do you think that this is going to confer any kind of an advantage on Chinese AI actors? And finally, do you find this permissiveness, if you think that there is any, to be troubling or problematic to you?
Sure. I think the permissiveness is arguably true, but I don't think it's the major factor. I think the major factors are the following. First, let's talk about what's an AI app, right? Most people think about AI, they think it's autonomous vehicles or robots, but actually that's kind of the later stage AI. The earliest stage is actually big data AI, right? Meitu, getting a lot of faces, learning how to make your eyes more beautiful. Baidu getting a lot of data, making the search results or the ads more accurate or better monetized. Taobao knowing what to promote to you, and Meituan knowing how to sell something to you to deliver to your home and so on. So it's big data AI. And then it's really, financial AI, you know, better loan determination for credit card fraud and insurance and banking and so on. And then it's a medical AI, you know, for radiology and x-rays and MRIs and so on. And then it's, you know, in intelligent devices, sensors, and then eventually robot and autonomous vehicles. Right. Behind all of this is large data that makes it possible. AI only works when you have a huge amount of data fed through algorithms to determine the outcome, right? What Go play should I make? What product should I recommend on Taobao?
Right.
How do I make her eyes more beautiful? Those are things with definitive markings. Which stock should I buy? Should I loan money to this person while he or she repay?
You need lots of data. That's what my former colleague Andrew Eng said. You know, it's the rockets and the rocket fuel. The rockets are, of course, the hardware and the algorithms themselves, you know, these massive DNNs. And then the rocket fuel is, of course, the data. And one is no good without the other. Right?
That's right. The rockets are becoming increasingly well known, at least decent rockets, maybe not the best. But a decent rocket with a lot of fuel can take you a long way.
And
that's where China has an advantage. So I think China's primary advantage is that there are many domains in which there is larger user base, therefore more data. And more data means you can make better algorithms. The second advantage is China's huge engineering population who can learn to become the rocket scientists, if you will. You need rocket scientists and you need rocket engineers. And the rocket scientists are sometimes people coming out of Baidu, Alibaba, Tencent, coming out of university, returning from the U.S., including from Google, Facebook, Microsoft. And the rocket engineers are the new grads who are rushing to get into gold rush of AI. So all of this, I think, are the main elements. I think the permissiveness that you talk about is maybe the freeness in which data is maybe used or maybe in some cases even traded or sold on the market. I do think the government is trying to limit and actually put as criminal activity the act of certain types of selling privacy data. So I think the laws in those areas are getting better. That's not to say there isn't a lot of data being traded and sold.
Right.
That isn't to say that companies are treating privacy data with the same level of respect that's treated in the US, but it's getting better, and it's probably not the main cause. And another thing that's important is, I think, the speed of execution is much faster in China. So companies that once they figure it out, data can be turned into making money and saving money, people work around the clock to figure out how to make that possible. And also, China AI algorithms, when applied to domains that didn't have AI before, the bar is much lower. In other words, the Chinese enterprise software, take credit card fraud detection as an example, it's much worse than the US. Right. So an AI company, has only a very, very low bar to pass to get bought, to show economic value. So I think all of these things will come back and make China the perfect market for AI, initially with big data, but eventually with autonomous vehicles.
In some areas, the kind of freewheeling Wild West data controls in China, for example, with respect to health data, you were telling me the other night that it's really, really segmented, that it's really siloed, that hospitals don't share, and it's out of this fear because of their awareness of just how the potential for abuse of data.
Yeah.
It seems to have inhibited the development of some kind of medical related AI technologies.
That's really too bad, but that's a universal issue. I think, generally speaking.
Yeah, not just China.
Yeah, I think every hospital is rightfully trying to protect the patient's privacy and data. But I think if we look at the greater good, I would advocate we should come up with some way to remove as much personal information as possible, but retain some degree of medical records and the images and the patient history and eventual survival rate and aggregate that across the world. That's a case where I think we might compromise maybe a little bit of reverse engineered privacy. We wouldn't purposely, you know, expose any, but then we could save so many lives and solve so many diseases. I think we as mankind should come together and figure out how to do that.
Absolutely.
But not happening.
What are your thoughts on the role that the Chinese government is playing in the development of AI? There are a lot of China watchers and certainly many American political leaders who hear about Beijing's enthusiasm for AI and frankly worry about the terrible Chinese killer bots or, you know, the stuff of nightmares. Should we be worried about an AI arms race? And how should the U.S. regard China or the Chinese government's AI ambitions?
I think both the Chinese government and the U.S. government are aware of how important AI is, and both are funding, supporting, helping companies to move in these directions. As far as military AI, I would have no idea since I don't engage in either U.S. or Chinese military AI. But we do know when we talk to the Chinese officials, they are knowledgeable, they are supportive, and they want to fund efforts to help make more platforms and more entrepreneurship possible on AI.
So, Kai-Fu, one trend that we've been seeing is that major deep learning pioneers, guys like Yann LeCun, who's at Facebook now, and Andrew Ng, who was at Baidu until fairly recently, have basically abandoned the universities, the big research institutes for the private sector, for the big internet companies. It's easy to understand why. I mean, they have the data, they have the hardware, they have the resources, they can pay the big salaries that attract these guys. But is this a danger to see, first of all, so much AI firepower accruing in the hands of a very limited number of large internet companies? And is it a danger that we're seeing sort of the hollowing out of the research institutions?
I think it is a danger worldwide, but in particular to US and Canada, because that's where a lot of the top scientists reside. I think we need to do something about that. It comes down to really three questions. One is, can someone in an academic institution get a large amount of data so they don't have to join a big one to do that? Two, can they increase their own pay or economic return in some way, shape, or form? And actually, three, can the amount of time they waste on writing government grant proposals be reduced? Because these are the three things that attract them to Facebook and Google and Baidu and so on. And I think we as sort of the open community should somehow come together and make that happen. So some opportunities opportunities that may be open for all of us would be, how do we collect an open data set and make that available to the academicians? And two, how should universities think about AI researchers and how to pay them? Universities sometimes pay MBA professors a great deal. Arguably, AI professors should get the same. And thirdly, a lot of these university professors publish a paper, then some entrepreneur takes it and builds a product and makes $1 billion. How should the professor find some way of getting at least some share of that? And currently there's the mechanisms are not clear except through rather generally bureaucratic university patent licensing offices. And that's way too slow because this is not about patent. It's about knowledge transfer and code transfer and time to market that could be in return, 5% share of the company or something like that. So, and then it's about the grant proposal. Maybe there should be, some kind of, gifting process where the professors can get their bases covered without having to write a very long proposals just to cover each student.
In the United States, we have the added difficulties of, that kind of research funding drying up under Trump, right?
I mean, yeah, so I don't know. Maybe we can help. Maybe the VCs can pull a fund that will support the researchers, because for the VCs,
it's in your long-term interest.
It's in our long-term interest. Right. We don't want everyone to go to Microsoft and Facebook and Google, right?
So can you talk about some of the AI plays that your company, your firm, Synovation Ventures, has made? And one of the things that really interested me at your talk the other night was the micro-lending service, Yongqian Bao.
Yes.
Could you talk about that company and some of the other AI investments you have?
Sure. We have a company called Smart Finance, and they make a product called Yongqian Bao. Let me describe it. It's an app that you download. And when you need, let's say $200, you click a button and in 8 seconds, the money comes to your phone. As I mentioned earlier, people use the phone for money nowadays through WeChat and Alipay. So this is extremely convenient to the average Chinese mobile user, because they probably generally don't have a credit card. So that option of getting a small loan isn't available. So Yongqian Bao was launched about 19 months ago. And this year, I would project it will do about 30 million underwriting of loans.
Oh my God.
So it's larger than almost anybody.
Oh, and so the AI component of this is the machine looks at the user and basically decides whether or not to lend them money.
Yes. Based on online activity, right? Or what
exactly.
Apps they
and based on what exactly? What's the data?
That's a good question, because most Americans would assume it's based on some credit report, which costs, some $20 to get. Can't possibly be that, because number one, they're not accurate. And number two, they're not targeting microloans. They don't exist. They're not targeting microloans.
There's no ratings agency.
And also, it's not economically sensible, because if you pay $20 for the report, you're only making interest on the $200 loan. It's not economical. So it's all based on content. Basically, you fill out forms. When you want to borrow the money, you tell them your name. You scan your ID. And then you give them your address. And then you upload some information from your phone. Such as, what apps you use, your contact lists, and those are scanned through they protect the privacy, but they scan it through and compare it with online databases to see if this represents a human person or someone who's likely to be fraud.
It seems like you could hack this, though. You could just create the right contact list. You could download the right suite of apps. You could just modify your behavior across a period of time. And
it's a game of cat and mouse, right? So the deep learning needs to constantly adapt to that. So of course there are default rates. Initially the default rates were quite high in the teens, and now they're in the low single digits after learning from data.
I'm still curious about this data, because I'm trying to picture what's on my own phone and whether you would lend me money or not based on my friends. Kaiser's one of my contacts. Is that going to be a black mark? I mean, is it, are you looking at, the contacts in the phone book, in the address book, and you have some kind of economic score for them, or, do they have criminal records, or what exactly is the information that you can extract?
It's not explainable. See, most of deep learning, you can't give a single reason. And that's not because deep learning is not smart. It's because we're not smart. We generally think there is a 3 or 4 dimensional answer to things, and we give you if then else, right? We would say, oh, it's because Kaiser is your friend, and because you make less than $5,000 a month, and you're only renting the place for 4 months, therefore it's unsafe to lend to you. That's the human way of thinking. But in the deep learning, there are 2,000 dimensions they look at, and these 2,000 vector space, they make a arbitrarily complex curve that separates the safe to lend money to people and the not safe to lend money to people. And that's the decision makes. There's no easy way to explain it without going through the 2,000 dimensions.
And so, I mean, there's a very real possibility that the machine will decide not to lend money to people with mole on their chin. Because it's found that people with moles on their chins just don't pay the loans back.
That's
a ridiculous example.
I'll give you a realistic example. Yeah. The type of phone that you use is a relevant member of the 2,000 classes.
Oh, yeah. So that makes sense to me.
Right. Yeah. And that wouldn't be something a loan officer would ever understand. The other question that comes up is, what about bias? It actually doesn't have human bias as we think about it, because it's not trained on human loan officer decisions. It's trained on whether you pay back the money or not.
Right.
So in order to build up the system, you got to give out a lot of bad loans and lose a lot of money and get a lot of money back and build up your training data yourself over time.
You know, we got a lot of questions for next time, but
okay.
Unfortunately, we're running short on time. There's one more, I think, a major theme that you've been thinking a lot about. I saw you in January at Davos, and I'm sure as you noticed, and I certainly did, there's a major theme that we heard repeated again and again in many sessions was the need to prepare ourselves for the inevitable economic disruptions that AI and advanced robotics are going to bring. And part of it, of course, is that we were all really chastened by the whole populist uprising happening around the world because of our elites' failures to really kind of prepare the world for globalism and the disruptions that was going to bring, the dislocations. So, you've devoted an awful lot of brain power to thinking about what we have to do to prepare for this future. And in your commencement address at Columbia, you said that in 10 years, you think that AI is going to replace half of human jobs.
Right.
That we're going to enter an age of confusion where many people, as you said, will maybe become depressed as they lose the jobs and the corresponding self-actualization.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So this is on top of a host of other potential ills, chiefly, greater wealth, income and wealth inequality, which is going to be really, really problematic, not just among individuals, but, within a country, but between countries as well, between developed and developing countries. What should we be doing? How should we be retooling and think about this in concrete ways?
Right. Well, first, there are some good things, too. I also mentioned the age of plenty, right? Because the AI will make so much money that the possibility of giving a universal minimum stipend, I think, is actually quite realistic if the governments get their act together. So coming back to what we as individuals should do, well, we should aspire to do things that the machines cannot do. So that would be the obvious answer. So what things can machines not do? Machines cannot create. They cannot come up with new algorithms. They cannot come up with a new form of art. They cannot create a new sculpture. They cannot write a new play or a new movie. So those types of things would be one class. The second type is be the user of AI. So when AI tools come out, you become very good at it and become a symbiotic combination so that you plus the tool becomes more than the sum of the parts.
Right.
But I think the third one is probably the most important because it's going to be all about people to people. The machines do not have emotion. They don't have love. They will not generate a warm and fuzzy feeling. They don't know love. They don't have empathy, and they don't have EQ. So this aggregation is what we human definitely have and machines definitely do not have. I don't think machines will ever get it, and certainly not get it within 20 years. So we need to think about, can the displaced workers and also can ourselves get into a service job that may be just a very caring concierge, a wonderful masseuse, a very, very talkative and fun bartender, knowledgeable and excited, passionate tour guide. Those types of jobs, I think, will be on the rise. And I think some jobs will go from professional to service, such as a doctor, when a AI doctor becomes better at diagnosis than a human doctor, the human doctor will be the bridge between the tool and the patient and make the tough messages easier to bear and give the encouragement that and the care and the attention and maybe the home visits that will give the patient a higher chance of making it through the difficulties.
So, Jiayang, there's still room for you, I hope. I mean, as a New Yorker correspondent.
We hope. But, you know, they might, you know, I mean, I can imagine how a robot might be better at doing her own fact-checking than I am.
The fact-checking part. Jeremy, witty and urbane podcast host. That's still on the table.
I think you three are pretty safe for 20 years.
I have to ask, I mean, when I was listening to your talk the other night and you spoke on these themes and you talked about, you know, for example, the value of a liberal arts education. And as somebody with a liberal arts education who, you know, spent the first 20 years of my adult life struggling to find two pennies to rub together, hearing this message from an engineer, I was wondering, like, you know, what's your advice to your own children? I mean, should we still be studying engineering?
I think you should study what you love and what you're good at. And I had a liberal arts education, but I also did computer science. I loved both parts, and I think they come back to be greater than the sum of the parts, right? If I just had the engineering education, I don't think I'd be writing this book. I don't think I would be thinking about implications for mankind. I don't think I'd be giving the commencement speech, right?
So it's easy. Just be a marvelously gifted polymath. That's all you need to do. That's easy, Jeremy.
Do what you love and work really hard at it. I think this hasn't really changed with or without AI. And but I do think a lot of liberal arts majors become a little more interesting in the age of AI, because the study of sociology, the study of psychology, the study of social work, the study of philosophy, all change because now there's this AI thrown into the equation.
In that commencement address that you gave, you said some very heartfelt words about your own experience with cancer.
Yes.
We're all very relieved to see how well you're doing, and our fingers are all crossed. But how did this experience change your outlook and your priorities? In a nutshell, I mean, related to this question, because it seems to have a direct correlation to your feelings about what humanity should be in the AI age.
Yes, it did. I think 10 years ago, I might have been a lot more sympathetic to Elon Musk's call that we should become cyborgs, because that seems cool and it seems like high tech and we want to maximize efficiency, maximize productivity, you know, and become very influential and change the world. But I no longer think that's the highest priority. I think maybe the creator of this world is sending us AI to remind us that these are not tasks that we should do anymore. The repetitive, the simple, the drudgery, and our pursuit of
took
money.
Took him a long time.
The pursuit of money and fame may have gone too far. Maybe it's a time to step back and think about the meaning of life and be with our loved ones and send out love feel happy because you're able to love someone and be loved.
Kai-Fu Lee, we are so grateful that you could make time to talk to us. It's an honor and a really great pleasure. So please join us for a recommendation for our listeners, won't you?
Sure.
Okay. Well, before we get to recommendations, I want to remind our listeners that the Seneca podcast is powered by SubChina. Check out the app and subscribe to the newsletter at subchina.com. You can follow SubChina on Twitter at SubChinaNews and on Facebook at facebook.com/SubChinaNews. If you like our podcast, by all means, go leave us a positive review on the Apple iTunes Store or on Google Play or wherever you go to review apps. This helps and it means a lot to us. Recommendations, Jeremy, kick us off, and then we'll go to Jiayang after that and then to Kai-Fu.
Okay. This one, maybe you've read already, because it's been burning up the internet. It's a cover story of The Atlantic this week, The Atlantic magazine, called My Family's Slave.
Yeah, Alex Tubman.
So the guy is Filipino-American. He's dead. He died a few months ago. And his family had what in China would probably call an IE, but she wasn't paid. She actually was basically a slave that they brought to the Philippines. And she brought up the author and his siblings basically almost as their mother. And stayed in America, never went back to the Philippines. And it's this sort of confessional essay about the story of his family.
It's generated a fair bit of controversy, too.
It has, for some reason. I don't know. You know, the I mean, this is when I kind of want to use that Chinese insult, Bai Zuo.
Bai Zuo.
I mean, Bai Zuo, sorry. The white left, it's kind of like the politically correct Twitterers are upset because, I don't know why they're upset, he didn't end patriarchy and colonialism early enough or something.
Okay. Well, we can talk about it another time. But,
yeah.
Okay, quickly, Jiayang, what do you have for us?
I'm recommending this documentary, which I was involved in only a small part. It's called Too Abacus, Too Small to Jail, and it is about the only bank in America that was prosecuted for mortgage fraud in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis. I wrote a story about this for The New Yorker in 2015, but I think the documentary really is able to bring some of these characters to life that a feature story is not able to do. It was directed by Steve James, who directed Hoop Dreams, and I think he's done a marvelous job.
Where can we see it?
It's in theaters starting May 19th, which might be today. I'm not sure. I no longer keep track of dates.
Abacus Too Small to Jail?
Abacus Too Small to Jail, okay. Documentary about this bank. So if you have a chance, go out and see it.
Great. Kaifu, what do you have for us?
I'm going to make an anti-recommendation for all the science fiction movies except one. Not that they're not entertaining and fun, but because they mislead us in this very important age of AI. The only science fiction movie that I think is not completely misleading is Frank and Robot. And I would recommend that you see it.
I've never heard of that. Frank and Robot.
Well, because it doesn't involve robots killing people, loving people, or controlling people. It's about a reasonably realistic robot that gets developed to accompany older people and the social problems they cause and how they solve that. It has drama. It's not dramatic. It's well acted. Frank Langella is an excellent actor. And I don't think it was a huge box office hit, but it's really the only one that I think will give us the proper way of thinking about when robots and AI come about, what we might do and what issues might come up.
Well, great. Okay. My recommendation very quickly is a piece from November of 2013. Actually, it's a few years old, called Friends Like These, How a Famed Chinese Dissident Got Caught Up in America's Culture Wars, by Jonathan Allen, a long-form Reuters piece about Chen Guangcheng and Jerry Cohen, Pastor Bob Fu, that whole kerfuffle. Wow. We had the very good pleasure last night of interviewing Jerry Cohen, so this has been very much on my mind. Anyway, once again, thank you so much for taking the time. I know you've got to get out of here. Jiayang, it was great to see you.
Yeah, same you. Here.
Kaifu, we'll hopefully talk to you again next time we're in Beijing.
You bet. Thank you.
Okay, great. Jeremy, good to see you as always.
Likewise.
Okay. The Cynical Podcast is powered by SubChina and is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldhorn. Special thanks this week to Anla Cheng and Sarai Darabi from SubChina. Thanks also to Trump International Hotel. No, I'm joking. I'm not going to thank them. Drop us an email at cynica@subchina.com and visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/CynicaPodcast. Follow us on Twitter @CynicaPodcast. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next week. Take care.